From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during World War I when the federal government developed housing for civilians for the first time. 83 projects in 26 states would house 170,000 workers and their families. And there was one consistent aspect to who got the housing. All of those workers were white. As author Richard Rothstein notes in his groundbreaking book, The Color of Law, quote, African Americans were excluded, even in northern and western industrial centers, where they worked in significant numbers. Federal policy sometimes imposed racial segregation where it hadn't previously been established, forcing African Americans into overpopulated slums, end quote. Rothstein details how Roosevelt's New Deal created the nation's first public housing for civilians who were not engaged in defense work. Most of it was for white families. And here's what made Roosevelt somewhat progressive compared to other American leaders. His administration offered some housing for African Americans, but kept it segregated, while some projects excluded black families entirely. The Color of Law documents how our country has intentionally segregated our cities for decades with federal policy and with intention. Segregation is not something that has simply happened organically by choice. Rothstein's book has been hailed as brilliant and essential by writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. Slate Online describes the book as a vital place to start in understanding our history of segregation. Rothstein's research takes us through the decades of segregation by policy and offers insight into the seemingly intractable problems we face today. Well, tomorrow, Pathstone is bringing Rothstein to Rochester for a public presentation, and they already have hundreds of people signed up. And they're going to tell you more about it. But first, we're glad to have the author, Richard Rothstein, joining us right here on Connections. Richard, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And thank you.
Well, it's nice to have you. And it's also nice to have with us in studio Stuart Mitchell, the president and CEO of Pathstone. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome.
And with us is Simeon Bannister, vice president of community programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Evan.
You've got an event tomorrow at 2 p.m. with the author, Stuart. And why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Because my understanding is you already have hundreds signed up for it.
We do. We're so thrilled that Mr. Rothstein was able to work this into his summer schedule to come to Rochester. We are using the amazing facility at the Lyric Opera or Lyric Theater building on East Avenue, right next to our offices at 400 East Avenue. I think it's 422, the corner of Prince and East Avenue. And yes, we have 450 people registered, and probably after this show there'll be more. So I'm a little concerned that people get there early and find a place to park and bring water because it's going to be a tad warm tomorrow. We're going to have reception following, and we really are excited to introduce Mr. Rothstein to the Rochester community.
Before we dig into the book, I would say, Simeon Bannister, first of all, you were on the program last week, and I'm grateful to you for giving us a nudge to let us know Richard's coming and to turn us on to the book. I mean, I'm finding the book to be the kind of book that ought to be read in every American high school.
Absolutely. That was a theme that we discussed last week, this notion that we need to have an accurate and complete history, and that Mr. Rothstein's work gets us a long way and a lot closer to being able to share that history. At the Community Foundation, we're right up the street from Pathstone, and have had the chance to collaborate on this event as a sponsor, because it's important to make sure that folks get that accurate history and have an opportunity to learn more about what's happened across our country, and frankly, to even focus on its implications for our community.
Richard, I will say that the consistent feeling I have in reading the book is probably anger to start. Some level of astonishment, though I consider myself decently educated, and yet this book was still, page after page, bringing new sort of horrors to my own understanding of what our country has done for so long. Tell us why you decided to try to collate so much of our history into a book like this, Richard.
Well, I did it because we have a national myth. It's shared by liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, Northerners, Southerners. The myth is that we have something called de facto segregation. It just sort of happened by accident. It happened because oh, bigoted white homeowners or landlords wouldn't sell or rent to African Americans in white neighborhoods, or maybe actors in the private economy like real estate agents or banks discriminated, or maybe people just like to live with each other of the same race, or maybe it's because of income differences. All of these accidental events is what created the segregation in every metropolitan area. And since it was accidental, it can only unhappen by accident, and we don't have any obligation to do anything about it. The reality is that the residential boundaries in every metropolitan area in this country were created and frequently, certainly sustained, reinforced, and perpetuated by public policy, explicit racial policy by the federal, state, and local governments, designed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another. It was a civil rights violation. It is a civil rights violation. The racial boundaries in this country that were created by government are as much a civil rights violation as the segregation of schools or water fountains or buses or any of the issues that we dealt with in the 20th century. And because they're a civil rights violation, government created, we have an obligation to remedy it. We have an obligation to do something about it. We can't simply continue to use the excuse that it's just accidental. So the reason I wrote this book is to hopefully inform people about their obligation, their constitutional obligation as American citizens, to take action to redress residential segregation.
I'm going to read a little bit from one of the chapters, this particular chapter titled Own Your Own Home, and that's in quotes. And I'm going to read a little bit, and then we'll turn it over to Richard to tell us more about this particular aspect of it. Frequently, African Americans who attempted to pioneer the integration of white middle-class neighborhoods were of higher social status than their white neighbors, and they were rarely of lower status. The incident that provoked Baltimore to adopt its racial zoning ordinance in 1910 was a prominent African-American lawyer moving on to a majority white block. Economic zoning without racial exclusion could not have prevented Frank Stevenson or his African-American co-workers from moving into subdivisions where many of their white Ford Union brothers were settling. To ban Frank Stevenson and his friends, different tools were needed. The federal government developed them in full contempt of its constitutional obligations. First, the government embarked on a scheme to persuade as many white families as possible to move from urban apartments to single-family suburban homes. Then, once suburbanization was underway, the government, with explicit racial intent, made it nearly impossible for African Americans to follow, end quote. The suburbanization of the country is told, I think, very effectively in your book and in the conversations you've had about your book. That is another aspect that I think a lot of Americans now assume was de facto as opposed to the policies. Tell us a little bit more about what we started to see in, you pointed to Baltimore, but there were so many cities, whether it was in the 40s, 50s, sometimes in the 70s, where there's video of a black family moving into a quote-unquote white neighborhood. What were the kinds of approaches, Richard, that the government actually took that beyond de facto segregation, that it was a federal policy, the suburbanization of the country?
Well, perhaps the most misunderstood of these is the policies in the mid-20th century of the Federal Housing Administration to create suburbs around every metropolitan area in the country that were for whites only, explicitly. You're familiar with these. They're in every metropolitan area. They're in Rochester. They're in the West Coast. They're in the Midwest. Perhaps the most famous is Levittown, east of New York City. A builder like Levitt, 17,000 homes in one place. He could never have assembled the capital to buy the land and build 17,000 homes on his own. The only way he could get the financing to build that development, and this is true of all the developers of suburbs across the country in the mid-20th century, the only way he could get the financing was by going to the federal government, the Federal Housing Administration, producing his plans for the development, making an explicit commitment to the Federal Housing Administration that he would never sell a home to an African American. The Federal Housing Administration even required Levitt and these other builders to place a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. That's how these white suburbs were created. Many of your listeners, if they look at the deeds of their homes, they will find that they are for Caucasians only. It's not enforceable anymore, but this is how the all-white suburbs were created. And then these suburbs were very inexpensive at the time. Levittown, for example, cost about $9,000 in the early 1950s. Today, that's about $75,000 to $100,000. those homes, though, today don't sell for $100,000 anymore. They sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. The white families who were subsidized by the federal government to buy these homes with FHA-guaranteed mortgages, the VA mortgages required no down payment for returning war veterans, those homes, families who bought those homes gained over the next couple of generations appreciation, equity from the value of their homes. The result is that today, African-American incomes are about 60%, 60% of white incomes, but African-American wealth is only 10% of white wealth. And that enormous disparity between a 60% income ratio and a 10% wealth ratio is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that we've never remedied. And that wealth gap determines much of the social inequality we have in this country today. Of course, the segregation that we've created also creates an achievement gap in schools when we concentrate the most disadvantaged children, African-American children in particular, in single schools where their social and economic disadvantages overwhelm the schools. It predicts health disparities between African-Americans and whites because so many African-Americans live in more polluted neighborhoods, have greater rates of heart disease and diabetes and stress that creates that. It predicts the mass incarceration and the outrageous interactions that we have between police and young African-American men, which couldn't happen if we weren't concentrating the most disadvantaged young people without access to jobs or opportunity in single neighborhoods. And I think this segregation that the government created also is one of the determining factors of the very dangerous political polarization that we have in this country today. How can we ever develop the common national identity to preserve this democracy if so many African Americans and whites live so far from each other that they have no ability to understand each other's life experiences or empathize with each other? So these are all results of explicit racial policy. You know, the Federal Housing Administration had a manual in which it not only prohibited the federal guarantee of bank loans to developers who would sell to African Americans, it even prohibited the guarantee of bank loans to developers of an all-white suburb if it was located near where African Americans were living, because the federal government's manual said that such a development would run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups and therefore couldn't be subsidized by the federal government. So people need to understand this history of unconstitutional federal housing policy that's created so many of the social problems that live with us to this day.
I want to underscore the Levittown lesson one time, just because for me it was so jarring, and it's probably the most effective way to describe a theft or a prevention of wealth in this country. So again, what Richard is saying is when Levittown's created in the late 1940s, builders, you know, mass builders couldn't get, you know, loans to do what, 1,000, 17,000 homes, unless they had explicit conditions that they would get that federal loan but could not sell to black families, and no homes could be resold to African Americans. That's part of the deed. So that's part of the deal there. A $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 Levittown home in the late 40s and early 50s might be $100,000 in today's dollars, but those homes sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. And generation to generation wealth accumulation often happens through equity. So you've got thousands of black families who literally couldn't do that. Even if they could afford to buy a house in Levittown in the late 40s and early 50s, they weren't allowed to do it. And there was extreme limitation on where they could live, often renting. So there's no equity, and there's nothing to pass to the next generation. So now, I guess the question is, let me start in studio, and then we'll go back to the author here. You know, Simeon, that is just one example that is so strong to me that shows that even if we want to argue today, hey, it's 2019, I didn't participate in that. I wasn't part of the government in the late 40s. I wasn't part of the developer that built Levittown or any of these other many, many developments in suburbs. You often hear that, right? You hear people say, look, I didn't do this. I'm not the racist who did this. But we have the condition today of having a huge wealth gap, and this book details why that gap exists. That's where we get to this difficult question of what to do. And yes, the R word, the reparations word comes back to at least to not about slavery necessarily, about wealth prevention and theft. How do we have that conversation? What do you expect tomorrow to yield when people start to grapple with this, Simeon?
Well, one of the things I hope people do, and here's a quick exercise for listeners, if you're sitting at a computer, just Google really quickly, Rochester redlining maps, and look at the neighborhoods that are shaded red on that map. And then think about, as you turn on the evening news, as you open the paper, where you hear about crime and where you hear about some of the degradation that happens in this community, think about the connection that happens there. Think about how those maps have shaped human behavior, how those maps have had the continuing echo across generations. And so the place to start is to alleviate and to hopefully ameliorate the ignorance, the pervasive ignorance about these issues. Mr. Rothstein started out right when he said that we have been living with a great myth, and it's time for us to dispel that myth. I'm hopeful that a lot of the folks that are coming tomorrow, we've got 450 folks that, at the very least, so many of whom have I'm sure, read the text already and will leave more informed, are ready to kind of carry this truth back to the communities that they hail from. It's time for us in this country, it's time for us in this community to tell the truth. Here in Rochester, this isn't about places far and long distant away. Right here in this community, the evidence exists about the kinds of things that happened in this community and where we are today. The other thing I'll just point out that really struck me, one of the stories in the book that really struck me was about the vice president, former vice president of the United States, Henry Wallace, who was largely hailed as, particularly at the time, given the period, a progressive, a liberal, and is also the progenitor of a policy for slum clearance using roadways. When I was reading the book, I came to that section and I grabbed my phone and I Googled, when did the inner loop start construction?
In Rochester.
And the book says by 1950 becomes the stated policy of the Federal Highway Department. The inner loop starts construction in 1951. It goes to a neighborhood that my father grew up in. And this is my own personal narrative. And perhaps this is one way, that one avenue to dealing with some of these issues, is to talk about our own personal narratives. The long and short of it is my grandfather came to Rochester in 46, very early, by the way, for African-Americans. Worked in construction, didn't get access to the GI Bill. Hey, there's no Bannister Construction Company in Rochester, because he couldn't borrow against his home to start a business because he didn't have that equity. There's no Bannister Construction Company because he couldn't go to a bank to get the dollars that he needed to finance that business. So these personal narratives, the differentiation, I do a presentation with some folks about these kinds of issues, and One gentleman and I were kind of comparing experiences, and his dad actually did start a construction company, and their families benefited significantly from it. But it provides the opportunity for us to at least start the conversation so that we can tell the truth and, again, dispel this myth.
Stuart, what do you hope comes out of the event tomorrow?
Exactly what Simeon is talking about. And for our from the Pathstone perspective, one of our major programs is developing housing for families. Mm-hmm. And often we're trying to figure out how to get housing developed for people who are working at lower wage jobs or maybe not working at all, trying to figure out how to get that, what we call affordable or workforce housing, into the suburbs has been almost impossible. Almost impossible. There's a few examples where us and other developers have found the ability to get some affordable into the suburbs, but for the most part, the restrictive zoning and the NIMBY reaction has made it almost impossible to do. So if we can change the narrative and begin to think about what it is that is a commonality for all of us and what's in our best interest to live in a much more integrated community and integrated society, we will begin to see the school systems improve. We'll begin to see people understanding and trusting and working with each other in a much different light. Right now, the segregation divides our city, and we don't need to repeat the story of what it is that we've done to create that. But I think having the work that Richard has done in a public discussion is something that we are very proud to be a part of.
Yeah, so Richard, I think this week in particular, there's been an interesting debate among American journalists about using phrases like racially tinged instead of just saying something is racist, as if that's taking sides. And last week on this program, when I said that it is a fact in this country that black families, by and large, have had wealth either prevented, they've been prevented from accumulating wealth, or had essentially wealth stolen. I mean, it's been the theft of wealth of African-American families in this country. That's a fact. That's not a political opinion. That's not a left-right thing. We can debate policy in response. I mentioned reparations. I think we can talk about what's appropriate or not. But for some reason, it's still debated as if this is a what's been the response to your book when people try to grapple with a factual history of this?
Well, the response, of course, has been quite surprising, stunning to me. When I first wrote the book, I couldn't get it published because we were in then, maybe you remember this, in a post-racial society. Nobody
oh, yes.
thinks that anymore.
Yeah.
We know we're not post-racial society. But there is, as you say, a tendency. One of, I think, the flaws of American journalism is that there's a belief that there's two sides to every story. So if you tell the truth about something, you also have to tell a lie about it. So you give both sides of it. We have an obligation to tell the truth. If I may, let me go back to something you referred to earlier, if I may.
Sure.
People who say that I wasn't here when all this happened,
mm-hmm.
and so I don't have a responsibility to do anything about it. I was once on a panel with a woman named Sherrilyn Ifill, a civil rights leader, and somebody asked a question just like the one you posed, and she looked at him and she said, well, you know, you eat hot dogs on the 4th of July, don't you? And what she meant by that was that your ancestors weren't here to sign the Declaration of Independence, but you don't have any hesitation to accept the privileges of citizenship. And by the same token, the privileges come with responsibilities, and those responsibilities are to enforce our Constitution and to remedy constitutional violations, whether our ancestors were here to create them or not. So I think we all have that obligation. We have an obligation to understand the truth. Of course, there are different interpretations, but there aren't two sides to this. There aren't two sides to the issue of whether the government segregated this country. The government segregated the country, and we as American citizens have an obligation to desegregate it.
So I will tell our listeners, and I see the phone ringing, if you want to join the program, we do want to hear from you. Your thoughts on what you're hearing as we talk to Richard Rothstein, who is the author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Richard, when Simeon Bannister says he wants people to try to kind of absorb this and maybe take this factual information back to their communities and all that entails, and sometimes some hard conversations, whether it's neighbors or families or friends, I want to ask you sort of a related question. What do you think, if your book is taught in high schools, and I imagine it is now being assigned in many classrooms, what do you think a 15, a 16, a 17, an 18-year-old who's going to start to grapple with this will think about their country, and what's the appropriate thing? I mean, if you're hoping anything, what do you hope for you know, young adults and for teenagers who are going to pick this up and read it and understand? What do you want them to take away from it?
Well, I'd like them to, not all of them, obviously, because no movement is ever encompasses everybody. But we had a civil rights movement in the 20th century. We need a new one now. The civil rights movement of the 20th century abolished segregation and everything from schools to colleges to water fountains to buses to lunch counters. But it didn't address an equally unconstitutional form of segregation, which is neighborhood segregation. And so I'd like young people to become motivated to become active in such a civil rights movement. It will start in many ways. One of the things that perhaps a group in Rochester could do would be to begin to make people aware of the fact that their own communities, their own homes, are by their deeds restricted to Caucasians only, and begin to take action to raise awareness of that, to demand that the county clerk place an addendum on every one of those deeds, asserting that the owner of that home welcomes people of all races and ethnicities to their neighborhood. And then there are further steps that can be taken once that awareness is developed. We can't start with changing national policy. We have to start with local action, and only young people can engage in doing that. Well, not only young people, but young people are always have always been a primary force in creating change of this kind, the civil rights movement. I will say that in the process of trying to develop this interest nationwide, we've now developed a curriculum that can be used in high schools, quite aside from reading my entire book, which may not fit into a high school history course, but certainly we have a curriculum unit that can teach this history, and anybody who is interested in getting that curriculum unit can write to me. My email address is easily available on the web, and I will send them that unit. It's free to high school teachers or to anybody really who wants it. We also have a short animated film, 17-minute film, that summarizes very briefly this history that is being shown in high schools around the country. So there is an effort being made to reawaken the knowledge of this history. We are not in a post-racial society, as I said. There's a great national discussion going on about race. It's being offset, of course, by the resurgence of white supremacy, being led by the President of the United States, unfortunately. But there's also a real national discussion about racial inequality and its causes, and I'm hopeful that more and more people will become aware of that inequality and its causes and begin to take action to support policies to redress it. I will say that the policies to redress it are easy to develop. Everybody knows, well, not everybody, but policymakers know what they need to do in order to redress segregation. What's missing is the new civil rights movement that's going to demand it, and it's going to have to start slowly and build to the point where it can effectively create that kind of change.
We will take some of your phone calls and feedback after only break, but before we go to break, I just want to ask Stuart, if I could, from Pathstone, one more time to tell our audience what's going on tomorrow and what you want people to know. 2 o'clock tomorrow.
2 o'clock tomorrow at the Lyric Theater building right next corner of East Avenue and Prince Street. Come early, bring a water bottle, it's going to be warm, and be prepared for a really exciting presentation. We have a panel that will include Simeon, that will follow up Richard's presentation, including Dr. Alice Young, who we may want to speak about a little bit later, is going to tell a personal story of her own family story that I think is going to be very compelling for people.
Tomorrow, 2 o'clock at the Lyric Theater, but get there early. They already know that hundreds are going to be there, and it's a community event with Richard Rothstein, who is on the line with us, the author of The Color of Law. Stuart Mitchell, the president and CEO of Pathstone, is here. Simeon Bannister, the vice president of community programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation, which is sponsoring tomorrow's event. Your feedback after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, the Summer of Food takes a look at meatless meat. The New York Times reports that the Impossible Burger is in such demand that the suppliers can barely keep up with it. And that's why some restaurants in Rochester have had an Impossible Burger for about a week or so, and then it's gone. Well, what about Beyond Meat that you can get at the grocery store or other varieties of meatless meat? We examine it, and you can share your thoughts next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Chris in Rochester is first on the phone. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was wondering, to what extent did Robert Moses have a hand in this unconstitutional suburbanization you're talking about, given his, mega projects in the metropolitan area of New York City?
You want to hit that, Richard?
Sure. There were many, many policies that all contributed to this, public policies of various government agencies. Moses was one of the contributors. As you may know, he had swimming pools in throughout Manhattan and in parks. And one of the things Moses's policies was to keep the temperature lower in swimming pools near black neighborhoods, because his view was that African Americans didn't like cold water, and if you kept the temperature low, they wouldn't be able to participate and use the swimming pools.
Oh my God.
He also purposely built low overpasses along the Southern Park Highway and the Northern Park Highway in Nassau County, because he wanted to prevent buses from being able to take African Americans to Jones Beach and make sure it was for whites only. So these were explicit policies on his part. He was quite explicit about how he did this. He was just one of many planners around the country who engaged in policies to either disadvantage African Americans or actually lock them into low-income segregated neighborhoods. You heard before a reference to the building of highways in Rochester and elsewhere. It was actually an explicit policy of public officials, local and state and national public officials, to use the interstate highway system, which began in the 1950s, to destroy African-American neighborhoods that were coming too close to downtown business districts. And in my book, I describe several of these that were deliberately routed to try to destroy African-American neighborhoods so that African-Americans would not be living near downtown business districts.
Let me read from Shane Wiegand, who I know is a friend of the panelists here, and I'm sure Shane's going to be there tomorrow.
Yes, he's on the panel.
He's on the panel tomorrow. He just writes to us on Twitter to say, "Great show. The builder Norman Hike and the Alliance Realty Corp. benefited from the same policies as the Levitt brothers. They put restrictive covenants excluding people of color on all their properties in Gates and Irondequoit." It's just one example of some of our history locally. So what we're talking about, whether it's Levittown, you know, we mentioned things like Pruitt-Igoe. I mean, these are things that have happened more famously, but that's our history locally, too. That is certainly the history locally. Let me get to Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Well, I mean, I wish it were a different subject, Rich, but go ahead.
You know, one of the questions that I always have is with even with all the changes in the laws and stuff that we do, another issue may be just getting people to be willing to live near black people, because property values go down just for the simple reason that black people are in the neighborhood. I know that's an insidious problem, but how do you deal with that?
Well, I'm going to start with Simeon Bannister because it's a little bit of what we touched on recently. Go ahead,
yeah,
Simeon.
So I can take a little bit of a crack at this. In my one of my past lives, I actually was a commercial real estate appraiser. We have a whole apparatus, and this is actually still taught in appraisal schools around the country, that adjustments, and so what an appraiser does is tries to identify what the value of a property is in any given market, what the market sentiment is about that property. There is a lot of subjectivity in a field that's assumed to be objective, and that subjectivity is where bias is allowed to play out. And so there are market adjustments that are allowed to be made where you can essentially devalue a property based on literally one's own personal and subjective bias that's supposed to be an analog for the marketplace, but doesn't always bear out that way, certainly not in the actual practice. And so there really is a need for significant reform. I think the brilliant nature of this particular text is that we see the very creative ways that people were able to legitimize and maintain segregation in this country. And we need to exercise equal creativity to demolish that structure.
Well, and you know, I'm looking at what we saw last night. I don't mean to make this overtly political, but let's just be real right now. So we have rallies that happen. So when the president goes to, I think it was North Carolina last night, and has a rally, and has, you know, it's kind of people are chanting, and people in that arena, I don't know, Richard, I don't know if they could pick up your book, read it, and then say, yep, that's our history, that's fair, what do we do about it? I mean, I feel like there's an obstinance, sort of an impregnability here when it comes to the way we have now sort of divided ourselves ideologically, politically. It's just very hard to break down. So when Rich says policy is one thing, but how are we going to change a culture that says, well, I don't want a black family in this neighborhood, or I don't want to live here, or I wouldn't want someone else. I don't know how, Richard, you know, to take that next step that Rich is talking about. I'm very concerned with how deeply entrenched these divisions now seem to be. How do you feel about that, Richard?
Well, they are deeply entrenched. They took several hundred years to develop. I'm very hopeful that it will take much less time to challenge them, but it's not going to be overnight. addressing the specific question that came up is what do you do about the fact that property values decline when African Americans move into a community? The only reason that happens is because there are so many white communities to which African Americans are excluded. If you had every community in the metropolitan area open to people of all races and ethnicities, and we have many policies that we could adopt that would do that. We could have inclusionary zoning provisions. We could place subsidized housing throughout the metropolitan area. If every community was diverse, there wouldn't be some communities where property values declined because African Americans were living there, because people would have no option but to live in another diverse community. So these have to be metropolitan-wide policies that desegregate all communities. And if you did that, I think gradually people's attitudes would change. One of the reasons that so many whites have negative beliefs about African Americans is because they saw African Americans living in impoverished conditions, in slums, in places where, and this is another aspect of public policy, that were denied public services that white communities got. When people live in slums, they have characteristics that people look at and think are characteristics of the people. They double and triple up with relatives. They subdivide their homes. They wind up sitting on porches rather than entertaining themselves inside their homes. White people look at these communities and they think, oh, slum characteristics, that's a characteristic of African Americans. They don't understand it's a characteristic of the public policy that herded African Americans into single overcrowded neighborhoods, not a characteristic of the people themselves. And you mentioned earlier that when African Americans tried to move into white neighborhoods in the 20th century, frequently they were driven out, certainly sometimes by violence, certainly by police protected violence. They had more money. They were higher income people, higher class people than the white neighborhoods they were moving into, for the simple reason that their supply was so constricted that they were willing to pay more for the same housing that whites willing to pay than whites willing to pay for that housing. So if you had a community that was surrounding a black neighborhood, a white community, African Americans tried to move in. Their homes typically were the best maintained, the best the highest quality homes in those neighborhoods, because they had no other choice but to live in neighborhoods that were below the income level of whites who were living elsewhere. These stereotypes were created by policy. They're a consequence of policy, and policy can undo those stereotypes. You know, one of the things we learned from the busing crisis that we've talked about so much in the last few weeks since the Democratic debate is that when we had busing in the 1970s, the white children in those schools that to which African Americans were bused came to their views of African Americans were transformed, and they became much less prejudiced, much less bigoted, much more. They had many African American friends, unfortunately, that era ended, and we now have segregated schools again, where people of different races, children of different races, no longer have access to each other and exposure to each other. So the stereotypes persist, but we have policy that we could do to redress this segregation, and it's going to require a change, a transformation in public opinion to create the pressure to create those policies. And I'm hopeful that if people understand the history, not that it's going to change overnight, but they will understand and begin to understand that these stereotypes are not natural observations, but the creation of policy, and they'll reconsider their thoughts about it.
Well, let me read an email from a listener named CJ, who says, "Thank you for sharing this important history. My eyes are being opened. I want to learn to discuss reparations. Some people object, saying, I don't want to write a check. Yet I see states and communities that are leaving populations making interesting offers. For example, I think Maine is offering to forgive or pay off student loans if young professionals move there. Aren't there creative ways to make reparations that would create wealth for future generations? What ideas do we need to include in these conversations?" That's from CJ. CJ, I appreciate that. I'll start with Simeon on this. I saw an African-American writer named Chloe Valderi write recently saying, just throwing an idea out there, how about for the next 50 years, free higher education for all African-Americans in this country as a form of reparation? And, you know, that engendered a lot of debate back and forth. CJ saying, what are the creative policies? What can we do? What are the tools if we're going to talk bluntly about this?
Sure. Well, I think the we have an entire civil justice apparatus that is structured around essentially creating reparations. Our civil justice system says that if someone has done something to you, if someone, whether by mistake or by intent, and it has had a material effect on you that is harmful, that you are entitled to some kind of compensation to redress either that error or that offense. And so it seems to me that what the real conversation is how to start to quantify the damage of slavery, of Jim Crow, of the series of policies that define northern segregation that have had a material impact on people of color in this country. And that's a conversation that it's certainly past time to have. One thing I did want to just chime in on, Evan, is that I think one catalyst that we need not neglect. I mean, Mr. Rothstein just made a wonderful offer to share his curriculum with schools all across Monroe County. That is a concrete thing that we can do. We are watching in this community right now challenges. We've certainly seen it at the Pittsford Central School District. We remember what happened at Spencerport a couple of years ago around the discussion with urban, suburban. We know that it's happening in Henrietta Public Schools and some others. Like, there's something we can do that is concrete right now. It is free. It doesn't cost you anything. Every high school teacher, particularly those that are teaching something like social studies or its equivalent, should be emailing Mr. Rothstein right now to get a copy of that curriculum and exploring how we can start to deploy it. Because the real deal here, and we talked a little bit about this last week, is that education is not just about the transmission of skills. It's about the transmission of values. It's how we socialize with one another and how we socialize young people to participate in the fullness of our society. And so, therefore, there's an obligation to make sure that what we are transmitting is not the myth, is not the lies, but it's the truth so that we're prepared to deal with each other more effectively. I'll just say as a parting kind of comment that literally, and this is not a euphemism, our species, and this isn't hyperbole, our species depends on the ability for people that are different to work together. It is a fundamental problem that underlies climate change, amongst other things. We have got to figure this out, and there's a real sense of urgency to do so.
So let me just say, to Simeon's point there, you know, I mentioned earlier, this is the kind of book that probably ought to be taught in all schools. It's called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. My son will read this book whether his school assigns it or not. that's the truth. But to Simeon's point, if you want to get in touch with Richard Rothstein, you know, he was saying, well, maybe schools aren't going to assign the entire book, but they've developed a curriculum that will help. Whether you're a history teacher, you teach civics, you teach social studies, whatever the case may be, if you're an administrator.
And a video. It's a 17-minute short video.
So, Richard, where again can people find it?
Well, I'll give you my email address. It's here's a short one, riroth@epi.org. That's for the Economic Policy Institute, riroth@epi.org. And I will send the link to this curriculum to anybody who requests it.
And we can put this on our website as well and make that connection very clearly. Shane, by the way, has a curriculum that he's put together that's going to be available in the Rochester school system. And Shane has got a terrific knowledge and working knowledge of our history in this arena. So that's another resource that we should be thinking about. I think if I can make one quick point around the imagine this idea that we have a cadre of champions of diversity in our suburban communities that are actually welcoming any of these conversations and confronting the people who are ignorant about the history and ignorant about their own views on issues, that if they could be educated and thoughtful and welcoming and encouraging, that idea of champions of diversity could begin to open up a conversation that maybe a place like Cobbs Hill redevelopment could become a conversation, a positive conversation about can't we all live together in a space that was built to house low-income seniors next to a park that we all enjoy? Why do we have to have a conflict around that? And I think we could find a way to do that if we could create knowledgeable, champions who are willing to talk about these now seemingly difficult conversations, but they don't have to be.
Well, let's get through as much of our feedback as we can, and then if you want, you can attend tomorrow. Is there a fee to attend? What's the cost for a ticket?
$25.
$25 tomorrow if you want to attend. Mike and Canisius next on the phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello. I'm in the middle of the book. It's a great book. I started reading it after our church took the Civil Rights Trail trip down to the South. And I got to say, you know, I'm a white guy, and I started the trip. It was about 50% African and have 50% European American, white. And,
I'm losing you, Mike. Unfortunately, I'm sorry about that, but we lost connection on the call. So let me grab Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay, this discussion started off, I believe, with talking about wealth disparities and how that came to be, and that housing segregation contributed greatly to that. And I agree with all of that. But somebody's talked about the people saying, well, I wasn't alive then, that's not my responsibility. But actually, people are actively doing things today that further create that wealth disparity. And Mitch McConnell, I think he was one of those that said, it wasn't my fault, and, you know, when they were talking about reparations. And yet it was, because he's the one that helped engineer that $1.5 trillion tax cut for the haves. And so he is contributing to it. And I wonder if we could focus on what people are doing today to widen that wealth gap. And there's certainly a lot of factors that go into that, but I think we could have a fairer tax policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Richard, is that a fair comment there?
Well, sure. We have a number of policies in this country today that are exacerbating inequality. They exacerbate economic inequality, but there's such a great overlap between racial inequality and economic inequality that it's the economic policies that help to support the segregation that we have. Your caller mentioned one. There are many others. There's the failure of the minimum wage to keep up with inflation. It's at a lower level than it's been in the past, and so many African Americans are working at minimum wage jobs that an increase there would help. President Trump has just appointed an acting Secretary of Labor whose career has been based in trying to bust unions. Unions are one of the major protectors of African American incomes and savings, so that's a policy that's if this appointee makes things worse, it will make things worse. So there are many economic policies. Race isn't the only problem we have in this country. It underlies so many of them, but it's not the only one. We have enormous difficulty with equalizing conditions of people, even regardless of race, and we need to address those as well.
Valerie says, please don't limit the reading of this book and the talk to social studies and civics classes or history classes. English classes can be mindful of the literature taught. We all can. That's from Valerie. Thanks for the show. Well, fair enough, Valerie. I appreciate that. But as we close the hour here, Richard, I know everyone on this panel appreciates your time tomorrow here in Rochester, 2:00 at the Lyric Theater, as part of this event focusing on our own history of redlining, segregation, policy that created segregation, not de facto segregation. Do you feel that we are moving into a society, Richard, where more people will be open-minded to this kind of information and absorb it? Or do you think that we've got some narratives that are going to be kind of defended and the people who are going to pick up your book might be already sort of predisposed to have a favorable view of it?
Well, we have a very polarized country politically today. As I said before, that's partly the result of racial segregation that keeps people apart and so they can't understand each other. But there is a growing awareness of this. My book has had a stunning reception. I can't deny that. And it's not just the people who were favorably disposed before. Most people didn't know this history, whether they were thought of themselves as racially progressive or not. The subtitle of the book is A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It wasn't unknown in the 20th century. Everybody knew that these suburbs being created were for whites only. Everybody knew that the public housing that we were building was segregated, separate projects for whites and blacks. So it's been forgotten, and people are reawakening to it, and I'm gratified that's happening. You know, let me just say that in the late 1990s, maybe you remember this, President Clinton, who was more sophisticated about these things than most people, said he was going to have a national conversation about race. And for about a week, he talked to himself, and that was the end of it. But we're now having a national conversation about race, and that is very encouraging. We have white elected politicians in the South going around and removing statues that commemorate the defenders of slavery. That was inconceivable even a dozen years ago, it was half a dozen years ago. We have a wide literature, not just my book, but the books of Ta-Nehisi Coates, you mentioned him before, or Bryan Stevenson or Michelle Alexander, that's being widely read, calling attention to this issue.
Well, Richard, let me jump in and thank you for helping lead that conversation. The author of The Color of Law, here tomorrow, 2 p.m. Go to pathstone.org to register for the event. They'd love for you to register in advance. $25 to attend, and they've got hundreds of people already signed up. Richard, we will see you tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Rothstein, the author of The Color of Law. Simeon Bannister and Stuart Mitchell helping sponsor and lead the conversation as well. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, more connections coming up.